Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to our second big hour of Open Forum here on Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. I hope that you had a wonderful Feast of the Assumption of Mary, wonderful feast in the life of the Church. And welcome back. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He wrote the book called The Fathers Know Best. Also wrote, did I just do that? A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist.
Yeah.
Did you ever have that happen, Jimmy?
What?
Just leaves the brain right as you're about to say it?
Oh, sure.
Really? Okay.
What I also have is skipping over what I was about to say because I'm thinking ahead and hitting the next thing.
Fun for the people talking with you.
It's even more fun for the people who are dancing to me because I'm thinking through the moves I'm about to call, say, in a square dance.
Yeah.
And I know where I'm going. I want them to, say, pass the ocean. But I've got two moves I need to set that up.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking where I'm going, I'll say pass the ocean. And they can't do it from the formation they're in because I haven't set it up yet.
Everybody snaps their ankles.
Yeah. No.
Ambulances pulling in.
They stand there and they go, what?
It's good to have you here, Jimmy. Please don't do that. Just answer the questions from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Let's not leave out the middle. That's an important part of every story. If you'd like to call and if you have a question for Jimmy about any aspect of the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, lines remain full from last hour. Shall we just dig right in?
Let's.
Okay. Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, listening or watching on Facebook. You are up next, Michael. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. My question is, if the devil decides that he wants to turn his life around and, you know, be good and get out of hell, can he?
Well, the way the Catechism of the Catholic Church is written, the answer would be yes, that if the devil decided to repent, then the divine mercy would be sufficient for his redemption, and therefore he would be able to be forgiven. The Catechism says it is not a limitation in the divine mercy that is responsible for the lostness of the fallen angels, including the devil. However, the way the question was asked, it was if this happened,
yes,
what would the result be? There's a prior question of can this happen? And there the Catechism's understanding is no, this can't happen because the way angelic wills are configured, they made a definitive choice for or against God. And that choice does not change. Just like when we die, our definitive life choice for or against God is made, and we therefore will continue on the course we've chosen. So if you choose in favor of God as a human in this life and you die as one of God's friends, you'll continue to have your will fixed on good. If you choose to reject God in this life, and that's your definitive life choice, you'll continue to reject God in the next life. So the devil and the other angels had a similar choice presumably at the beginning of their existence, but without the variability that we have in this life. So when they made a choice, they continued on that forever after. And so the way the Catechism expresses it, the devil can't change his choice, but if he could, the divine mercy would be sufficient for his redemption.
Michael?
Thank you for that explanation. If people are ignorant of God in some way or another, are they given – is it purgatory?
Well, no, not necessarily. Purgatory isn't related to ignorance. It's related to the amount of purification that you need in order to enter heaven. Over the course of the Christian life, God works with us in various ways, even if we don't realize it. He's working even in the lives of people who don't know him or reject him, or who have no conscious knowledge of him in this life. If you die as a friend of God, but you, even if you don't know him, but you're still a person of goodwill who would follow God if you had conscious knowledge of him. Let's say you just never heard the gospel preached.
Yeah.
So it's not your fault you didn't know about God. But if you would have followed him, then you die in his friendship. And whatever degree of purification you need to be perfect with God in heaven, that's the degree of purification you'll get in purgatory, which is simply the final purification. So it is possible for people who don't know about God to be saved, and whether or not they need purgatory is on the same basis as the rest of us who do know about God. It's how much purification do you need, because all of us are going to be perfect in heaven, and if we haven't dealt with all of sin and its consequences in this life, then we need to be purified of that before we enter the glory of heaven.
Michael, thank you very, very much. Actually, that question about the devil gives you anybody who's carrying around a thought, well, God wouldn't forgive me.
He would forgive the devil.
Yeah.
If the devil chose.
That's pretty definitive.
Yeah.
About how serious.
Another parallel instance. This is a story I heard about that occurred in a Protestant seminary with a professor who's now passed on. But when Jesus goes to the country of the Gadarenes and he meets the Gadarene demoniacs, and the demons say, please don't punish us right now. Please let us go into the pigs instead.
Yeah.
And Jesus does. The professor was making a rhetorical point to his class, and he's like, how could Jesus answer the prayer of demons? You know? And one of the students said, well, he answered mine.
Oh, what a wonderful comeback. Yeah.
And the professor said, that's the best answer I've ever heard.
It does give you a sense of confidence, though.
Yeah.
Like, ask. And if he was kind enough to send the demons into the pigs, it didn't work out.
If he answers the prayers of demons, he can answer yours, no matter how bad you may think you are. You're not as bad as the demons.
No, but it was bad for whoever owned those pigs.
Yeah, but they learned a valuable lesson.
Okay.
The God of Israel is the true God, because they were not Jews in the country of the Gadarenes.
That's why they wouldn't have pigs, I guess.
And so they saw a powerful demonstration of the God of Israel's power and of his compassion on suffering people like the demoniacs.
Yeah, right. Beautiful. Matt in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You are next. Your question for Jimmy Akin, please, Matt.
Hi, thanks. My question is regarding the change in the catechism on the death penalty.
Uh-huh.
If I understand correctly, it mostly is about kind of a paradigm shift between the old way of looking at criminal penalties, which was inflicting a just punishment on the offender, versus the new way of looking at them, which is protecting society from the offender. So
hopefully rehabilitating the criminal.
Right. So my question was, I guess, how do we know that the new paradigm is right and the old paradigm is wrong, and when did that shift occur?
Well, the shift occurred principally over the course of the 20th century, and in terms of – and I personally wouldn't put it in terms of saying the old way of looking at things is wrong and the new way is right. I think that that is a way of framing the two that is a little more that pits them in opposition in a way that I'm not sure is the way the Holy See would look at it, because the Holy See hasn't looked at it in those terms. Rather than saying this way was wrong and this way was right, the Holy See has expressed it in terms of this has been the developing understanding and of these matters. And so I tend not to want to get too far from the language that the Holy See itself has used. I'm thinking here of the letter that was issued along with the catechism change by Cardinal Luis Ladaria, who's the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome. And in terms of is there a preference for later understandings over earlier understandings, whether it's of this topic or any other topic? The answer is that although it's not an infallible rule, there can be ups and downs and there can be misunderstandings and corrections and things like that over the course of church history. But there is a general trajectory, and I talk about this in my new book, Teaching with Authority, that's about to come out in less than 2 months now. There is a general trajectory in the development of doctrine where the Holy Spirit progressively leads the church into greater and greater understanding of the truth. And so all things being equal, you would have a preference for later formulations that are more developed and more refined over earlier formulations that are less developed and less refined. So, for example, you would have a preference for the way the doctrine of the Trinity came to be expressed after the councils of the fourth century that formulated the language for the doctrine of the Trinity rigorously, compared to the way the fathers living before the fourth century articulated the doctrine of the Trinity. They had the same basic idea, but they didn't have all of the pieces in place necessarily, and they didn't have the clear and, you know, precise way of expressing it. And what's true on that teaching is true on many others, that as the Holy Spirit, in keeping with Jesus' promise from John 16:13, leads the church into all truth, as the Holy Spirit helps us refine our understanding of the revelation God gave us, it's a progressive process, and so the later formulations are going to be more precise and more developed than the earlier ones. And so there's a general preference for later, more developed formulations.
Okay, Matt?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. I want to let you know that right now they've got the back-to-school sale on at shop.catholic.com. Some of Jimmy's books are on sale. The idea of the back-to-school.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Oh.
Which ones?
The Fathers Know Best is on this list, and A Daily Defense. And if I was thinking, if I'm thinking, oh, I got a son or daughter going off to college, what's a good book to put in their hands? I would think Daily Defense.
Fathers Know Best and A Daily Defense. They're both good to put in their hands.
Okay, yes.
Or in their pockets.
If they have big pockets, these are big books.
Yeah.
And then also on sale, well, they just give another example here, The Essential Catholic Survival Guide, which is a great book. And several other things, and they've kind of been selected or curated to be very helpful to someone heading off to school. The way you get this stuff is you just go to shop.catholic.com, visit the back-to-school category, special back-to-school category there at the site, and you will get information on how to get these things at reduced price. Shop.catholic.com.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The reason people should listen is so they can get excited about the faith and then share that faith with others. Because that's what it's about. When we say, Jesus says, come follow me, but he also said, go and make disciples. We'll give you the tools needed for the new evangelization. Because that's the call to bring everyone into a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Open Line with Father Larry Richards. Tonight, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and willing to take your questions on any aspect of the Catholic faith. And you usually say when Jimmy's here, if you have questions of a more generally religious or philosophical nature, happy to take those as well. You don't have to be Catholic. You can be Catholic. Anybody's welcome to call, 888-318-7884. We go now to Daniel in Missouri, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Daniel, thanks for downloading the Catholic Answers app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Well, thanks for making an app.
you're welcome. I work day and night on that thing.
So when I heard that Jimmy was a big Doctor Who fan, I thought, oh, man, I have a great question for him. I'm a huge nerd as well. I'm a fan of urban fantasy novels. Jimmy, have you heard of the Dresden Files?
Yes, I have.
Great. There's actually a Catholic character very well portrayed. And I want to ask about the intersection, the theoretical theological feasibility of the intersection that goes on in these sorts of fictional worlds.
Okay, I should warn you. I haven't read any of the Dresden File novels. I have seen an episode or two of the TV show, though.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, every mythology is factually true, but there's the existence of God in this world, and he's all powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you have archangels who are kind of on par with these, you know, the old pagan god, sort of beings. Like Mab from Old English folklore versus the apocryphal Guriel. They're both, you know, sort of powerful characters.
Yeah, it's not, that's not, not, that. Okay. Well, I'd say it's not too different, actually, than the understanding that that you find in the Church Fathers and that arguably is even there in the Old and New Testaments, that these texts don't always challenge the existence of the beings that are worshipped by other cultures, but they regard them as not to be worshipped by the followers of the true God, and they regard them as being inferior to the true God. So you would have church fathers, for example, saying that the gods of the Greeks, like Apollo or Diana, would be, or Artemis, would be fallen angels. So they're essentially angelic beings that are leading people astray by trying to cultivate worship for themselves.
Okay.
And this is a view that it's very common in the Church Fathers. It's something that that pops up repeatedly. It's arguably present in the New Testament, and it's also arguably present in the Old Testament, where you have – now, they're not dealing with Greeks for the most part in the Old Testament, but they are dealing with various ancient Near Eastern peoples. And at times, you'll find expressions where you'll have a Hebrew saying to a non-Hebrew, hasn't your God so-and-so given you this land that you live in? And he's not challenging the existence of the pagan God so-and-so. Now, you could say, well, he doesn't believe at all in the pagan God because he just wants the person to go away and stay in their own land and leave the land that Yahweh has given to us.
Yeah.
And you could argue he's just using this as kind of a figure of speech to get the guy to buy the premise leading to the conclusion that he's really interested in. But that's speculative. That gets a little further away from the text than some scholars would be comfortable with because it looks like the Hebrew figure is acknowledging the existence of this pagan god, presumably in a subordinate way to the true God.
Right.
But you could at that point say, well, okay, he's just wrong. He's living at an early stage. His culture, as we know, Israel was partially corrupted by pagan beliefs, and maybe this Hebrew figure is one of them. Just because someone's in the Bible doesn't mean all their ideas are right or all their actions are good. I mean, David, you know, committed adultery, but he was also a man after God's own heart. So he was on the side of right but with flaws. Maybe this guy is the same way.
Right.
Or it could be that that he's giving voice to a worldview that said these other beings are supernatural beings are real and they have zones of influence in the ancient world that the true God has allowed them to have, the true God who's the creator. And so he's relying on that. Now, that's a perspective that seems to be reflected in the book of Daniel, because in Daniel, the angel Gabriel shows up to talk to Daniel at one point, and he says, I would have been here sooner, but the prince of Persia detained me, and Michael, the prince who has charge of your people, came to my assistance in battle and enabled me to get through with this message to you.
Yeah.
And so that presupposes a worldview where you have these angelic supernatural beings that God has created having special charge of different peoples or zones like Israel and Persia. Mm-hmm. And there can be conflict between them to where the prince of Persia is not on God's side and is impeding the actions of people who are on God's side like Gabriel.
Yeah.
And it takes Israel's defender, Michael, to intervene to let Gabriel complete his mission.
Yeah. That's
so does that shed some potential light on it, Daniel?
Yeah. And I also wanted, as a corollary, to ask, what is Genesis 6 talking about?
Ah, the Nephilim?
Yes.
Yes.
The so-called sons of God. And I'm familiar with the, you know, Israel's gradual journey toward monotheism. You know, mm-hmm. Abraham came from polytheistic, and it was, you know, this gradual worldview change. But is that really all there is with the text of Genesis 6?
Genesis 6 is a really interesting text, and I've done some research on it. I recently ran across some new research that I haven't had time to fully assimilate yet. Basically, there are different ways of looking at the text of Genesis 6, and according to they fall into two basic categories. There's a supernatural understanding and a non-supernatural understanding. And actually, there's a third, the alien astronauts understanding, but that doesn't have any traction in biblical scholarship.
Okay, good to know.
The supernatural understanding says that the Nephilim in Genesis 6 are supernatural beings of an angelic nature or, you know, quasi-divine nature. There's some kind of supernatural beings that are subordinate to God and that are up to no good, and they crossbreed with human women and give birth to these remarkable human beings who are larger in stature and do mighty things and have impressive reputations. So that is a viewpoint that coheres well with the archaeological evidence from the ancient Near East. That kind of thing was a common belief in many cultures. On the other hand, there's the naturalist understanding, which would say that the Nephilim are human beings of one kind or another. They're special, they're remarkable, but they're still human beings. Proposals for who they are could include descendants of the line of Cain or the priests who are in this period in history. This is pre-Israelite, but they would have been like priests or rulers who are sometimes identified in ancient Near Eastern literature as sons of God. And they then crossbred or bred with ordinary women. But because of their special talents and special elevated statures, their offspring were remarkable. They would have grown up with social privilege and trained to be warriors, and they were mighty men and maybe bigger of stature than ordinary people and stuff like that. And this interpretation is very common in the church fathers. So those are the two basic views. From a modern perspective, a challenge to the first view would be, well, okay, angels don't have bodies, so how could they produce offspring? Well, the answer to that presumably would be angels can take on physical form. We see that happening in the Bible in various places. They can manipulate matter We see them doing that in various places, you know, when they intervene in the order of nature to cause supernatural events or miracles happening. So so if they can interact with matter, if they can assume human form, then maybe they could breed. You know, that would presumably be the answer there. The question then would be, do you buy that God would allow that? So those are kind of the range of options. I don't have a settled opinion on this myself. It's a passage I continue to research. And frankly, it's one of the most mysterious passages in the Bible, in part because it's so brief. We have so little data to go on that it's given rise to these different interpretations.
Thank you so much for those questions, Daniel. It's almost given as an offhand remark, really. Mm-hmm. And then you look at it and go, wait, what?
Yeah.
Back up. I need to know more about that.
That's part of the issue because it's mentioned very briefly as an item of, I guess you could say, popular culture. This is kind of a pop culture reference. This is where these famous guys came from.
Yeah.
And that's all. And if we were ancient Israelites, we'd know more about them.
Yeah, right. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, open forum, our topic. If you have questions about the Catholic Church, maybe just one question that's been nagging at you, or maybe you need help answering a question of a friend or a relative, all that's welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
What are the basics of Jewish belief and practice? How does modern Judaism differ from the Hebrew religion of the Old Testament? Is Christianity to blame for historic anti-Semitism and for not doing enough to stop the Holocaust? Judaism is the ancient foundation of Christianity, yet many Catholics remain ignorant of its beliefs. 20 Answers Judaism dispels that ignorance with a helpful overview of Judaism's history, its forms of worship, and sources of doctrine and more. 20 Answers Judaism is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
Is the Church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. If you just don't understand something about the Catholic faith, Call to Communion is the show for you. Join us Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Just listen to that drumming. Wild drumming. That's the groovy music. Just like to sit back and relax and enjoy that. I forgot it was Thursday. It felt like Monday. It felt so much
it
like
does.
Monday
yeah.
that I forgot it was Thursday.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not that together a person anyway, so it's
you just become unstuck in time.
I do.
Billy Pilgrim.
I do have Billy Pilgrim has that problem.
Yeah.
Probably to a much greater
and
degree than I do. And who?
Zothras.
You have to help me on that.
Zothras is Zothras.
Oh, that's an excellent point. Thank you for answering syllogistically.
Tautologically.
Tautologically. Thank you. 888-31.
I need another premise and a conclusion to answer syllogistically.
It's fun talking to you, Jimmy Akin.
Yeah.
Even though I only understand about half of what we're talking about and I just pretend like I'm keeping up, it's fun talking with you.
I'm like that in sports discussions.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Right. You look, Philip from Nacogdoches,
Nacogdoches.
Texas, is back.
Hey, cool.
Really?
Let's talk to him.
Let's see if what's up with Philip. Philip, we just spoke with you last hour.
Well, we tried. I was cut off. So and the answer came, and I was not. There was a clarifying thing that I wanted to make sure that to get out there.
Okay.
The reason,
Philip, I wasn't on last hour, so I didn't hear last hour. I don't know the context, but if you can direct whatever your inquiry is as a question to me, I'll be more than happy to see if I can
help. Just ask it like it's a new question for Jimmy.
Like it's a new question. All right. Well, the question is about the right. So RCIA, when adults are to be anointed with the oil of catechumens, in the ritual text, it says that it should not be done at the vigil, but during the period of the catechumenate.
Right.
Which is before the rite of election. The Roman Missal says, in the text for the vigil, says if it's at some point in the Mass, it says if it isn't done, if the anointing hasn't taken place in the preparation rites on Holy Thursday, it should be done here. So which is it?
Okay, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to punt until next Thursday. I'll be on again next Thursday. I'm going to need to go and look in the actual documents because we're dealing with a matter of a very technical nature that doesn't come up that often. But I'm happy to do that. I've got the relevant documents. I'll take a look and report back on the show first. I don't know if I'm on first or second hour next Thursday, but I'll report back at the – I'm told I'm on first hour. Okay. So I'll report back at the top of the first hour next Thursday with information. Just want to make sure I understand the question is – when should the oil of the catechumenate be applied to catechumens in the process of their reception into the church? Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. I'll be happy to come back with an answer on that.
Philip, Jimmy must either really like you or Nacogdoches, Texas or Guadalupe.
Well, I do
Radio.
Like – I mean, I'd be happy to report back for anybody, but I do like Nacogdoches, Texas. It is a place I've been to many times. It's in East Texas near the Louisiana border. And I grew up – well, didn't grow up. My family – my mom grew up near there. And my family ranch is just outside a town right next to Nacogdoches named Broadus.
Oh.
And in fact, I own land there. I own part of the old family ranch. And so Nacogdoches and San Augustine and Lufkin and Broadus, those are all special places
to me. That's like your stomping grounds there. So Philip, you lucked out with that question for Jimmy, but she's got to wait a week and Jimmy will get back to you. 888-318-7884, our number here. Let's go to Mary in Houston, Texas, also listening on Guadalupe Radio. It's Texas Day, apparently, here at Catholic Answers Live. Your question, Mary?
My mom also grew up there.
In Houston.
In Houston. I still have aunts who live there, aunts and uncles.
Oh, I'm glad you were able to tell us because I believe Mary is currently catching up with us by listening to the
radio. Yeah, it's important once you get on the phone line to listen to your phone, not the radio, because there's a time delay. And if you're listening to your radio and not the phone,
in
then
a second,
we get a
Mary's
phenomenon
gonna go,
like this.
Oh, they're talking to me. But is it going to happen, Mary? Are we going to get you? Or
maybe we need to come back to Mary if we can.
Oh, I was really looking forward to a Texas
Seemed to be
Tuesday,
going along for a while.
All right. Steve. Listening on the EWTN app, I'm sure Steve is ready to go. Steve, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, I am ready to go.
Boy, you are, Steve. All right.
For you.
Okay, I've got a question. I'm going on vacation in a couple of weeks, and there is a Greek Orthodox church near where I'm going to be staying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that would be acceptable to count as my Sunday obligation, and if so, would I be able to go to communion?
Okay. In a circumstance where you're traveling and and there's no Catholic church nearby, you effectively don't have a Sunday obligation. If you can't reasonably get to a Catholic church, you don't have to go. And you're welcome in that situation to go to a Greek Orthodox Mass or Divine Liturgy, as I assume they would say. You're welcome to go, but it technically doesn't count to fulfill your Sunday obligation because you effectively don't have one in that situation. If you can't reasonably go to a Catholic Mass, you could just stay home and that would be perfectly fine. But you also would be welcome to go to an Eastern Orthodox liturgy. And if they are In a circumstance like that, where you're not able to approach a Catholic priest for communion, then as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, you would be welcome to receive communion at a Greek Orthodox service, provided you're otherwise properly disposed. You know, you've been to confession or you don't have any mortal sins, in other words, since your last confession, provided they're willing to give you communion. We want to respect their discipline as well. And so if they're willing to give you communion and if you're properly disposed for it and if you can't approach a Catholic minister, then you would be welcome to receive communion there.
Okay. What if there is a Catholic church nearby, then it'd be necessary to go there then?
Yeah, to fulfill your Sunday obligation, you would need to go to the Catholic Church. You could also go to the Greek Orthodox Church out of curiosity, let's say, if you've never been to a Greek Orthodox service. But you would need to go to the Catholic Church and receive communion in the Catholic Church if the Catholic Church is within reasonable distance and you're able to go there.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks so much. We're going to check back in with Mary, who I'm just feeling really good about this. Mary in Houston, Texas, you're on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I apologize. I feel like I should have been able to find the answer to this question on my own, and I've looked and I can't.
That's okay. What's the question?
So a few weeks ago, my husband, who is a non-Catholic, and I were traveling at a different parish, and the priest during his homily mentioned a story. We understood, he said it was from the Bible, about Solomon, and the priest said, and I think his name is Simeon, and Simeon was a wealthy man who was cruel to his servant, and Solomon invites him to a feast to teach him a lesson. Simeon fasts the full day, and then as part of the rules of the feast, isn't able to object and has to remain happy the whole time, and he's very hungry. And then Solomon doesn't let him eat all day or during the feast, has entertainment, invites him to spend the night so he doesn't eat. And he leaves Solomon's palace the next morning with a change of heart and is kind to his servants.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been able to find that anywhere in Kings or Chronicles. I don't know where else to look.
Yeah. So I think there's a good reason you haven't found it. I think the reason is because it's not there. I'm not familiar with this story either. It sounds to me as if it is my guess is that it is it could be one of two things. It could be a modern made-up story by either the priest or someone in recent times, perhaps an author for the homily service the priest is using. It also could be an older story that could have come from – there's a term that's used in Jewish circles, midrash. And a midrash is kind of a story that elaborates on some biblical incident or theme. And here the theme would be the wisdom of Solomon, how Solomon did this wise thing to get this cruel master to shape up and have compassion for his servants. So it could be that this is an older midrash, or it could be it's a modern made-up story, which would also qualify as a midrash. But it is not one that is found in the Bible unless I am very much mistaken.
Okay, Mary?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Jimmy, I don't want to shock you, but you have a...
I shock easily.
I know. This
Please
might,
be
this might
careful.
Shock you. You have this MP3, Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book.
Uh-huh. Sure. That's not shocking.
It's free right now.
Really?
Yes.
As long as I get my royalty.
You'll be less shocked.
Yeah.
If you go to Catholic.com, it's up on the banner there. You can get this free MP3, Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book. It's the most mysterious in part because it's a form of literature that is notoriously hard
to... Apocalyptic, yes.
Yeah, hard to decipher. But also, it seems to me there are a lot of... there's a lot of attempts to kind of make it say all kinds of different things,
and that just adds to the mystery in an extrinsic way because you then have to cut through all these added interpretations.
So let me ask you this. If I could take a guess at the underlying message, and you tell me if I'm in the ballpark.
Okay. Of Revelation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. God wins.
Those are the two words I was going to use.
Okay. I'm so glad. I think it's probably you that told me that at some point because it was there in my head. And yeah. Okay.
No, great minds think alike.
Yes, especially when one listens to the other one and then repeats back to him what he said. Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book. Free MP3 available now at Catholic.com. Just click the banner and you got it.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, what do you think you're going to look like in heaven? Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. So I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, what do you think I'll wear in heaven? And they all said with one voice, armor!
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic. Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. And up next is Jack in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 820 AM. Jack, your question for Jimmy.
Gentlemen, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. My priest, who I went to and asked for some spiritual direction, has me reading the Interior Castle right now.
Okay, wow.
And my question is this. I started into this, and I thought this woman was out of her mind. She goes back and forth. She flips
Saint,
forward
Saint Teresa
and,
of Avila.
In her material and flips backward. But I decided I was going to slog through it, and now I can't put it down.
Oh, okay.
I'm just enthralled with it. And so here's my question: mm-hmm. When we're reading something like this, or John of the Cross, or some of the some of the other mystical writings, are we doing this primarily to understand it? Because that I'm really not doing, or are we reading it to get some kind of grace out of it?
Well, you mean as an exercise in spiritual reading?
I don't understand.
Okay. Well, so when we read something, we have different people have different purposes. You could take, let's say, The Interior Castle or The Dark Night of the Soul or any of these works, The Imitation of Christ, and you could read them simply as a historian. You know, you could be reading them in order to document the religious. You could be an unbeliever and be reading these things to document the ideas that were common in the time of the person who was writing the work in question. Or you could be writing your dissertation just to situate on this saint and say, okay, this is what happened in this person's life. This is what this person thought. I don't believe any of it, but I'm writing to get my doctorate out of this. So you could have all kinds of different motives in this. When, though, we're doing something as a spiritual exercise, and those motives are not wrong axiomatically. I mean, it can be legitimate to have a historical motive when, you know, to write the history of an era. St. Luke did that.
Yeah.
So that can be legitimate. Getting a degree in higher education can be legitimate. But when we're reading something as a spiritual exercise, like when if a spiritual director has encouraged you to do something, then the underlying motive is to grow spiritually, to grow closer to God and receive His grace and whatever insights he may choose to give you through the work as a way of benefiting you as a whole person, not only receiving grace, but also receiving intellectual graces, the grace of understanding that can then lead to a number of benefits, including a feeling of greater closeness to God, perhaps,
practical direction for how to do certain things in your life, what to do and avoid, a sense of wonder and awe at God's mystery. All of those are things that have a spiritual component. Some of them have emotional components. They also have varying degrees of intellectual components. So when we're doing something as a spiritual exercise, the fundamental purpose is to grow spiritually, but that doesn't exclude it having an emotional or a practical or an intellectual dimension as well.
Jack, does that comport with your experience? Like it's interesting to me that you are, even though you say you struggle to understand it, you can't put it down.
Yeah.
Well, there are some things that she's saying that seem to strike home, and I'm sure I'm going to get this all wrong, but I mean, the theme I seem to be taking out of it is you're not chasing after emotional experiences with God. You're just kind of following the dictates of I'm getting it wrong, of your confessor or whoever it may be, and when nice things like that happen, that's great, but you sort of keep going. And I don't know. I mean, that having been said, I seem to have been hit with a really powerful emotional experience out of this for whatever reason. And I couldn't put my finger on what it is, but, I mean, I would say
it's great that you've had a response on an emotional level to this work. That's wonderful. That happens from time to time in the spiritual life. You're correct. That's not what we're seeking. We're not just to be led around by our emotions, and there are times where we need to press on in something despite of our emotions. But it's great that you're having a time like that right now. If you can't put your finger on it, that's okay. You know, continue to think and reflect, and maybe you will be able to, or maybe you won't be able to. There are things that we experience in life that transcend the ability of words to express. And if in this life you're never able to put your finger on exactly what it is, that's okay. Just trust God and keep moving forward.
Jack, I'd just like to express my sympathy with you a little bit, because this happened to me with St. Teresa of Avila. But it was her book, The Way of Perfection, however, and I still don't feel like I understand. But it was something about it was a powerful invitation to deeper relationship with Jesus. So I just wanted to encourage you in that. I think it may be something about St. Teresa. I don't know. She also has a wonderful autobiography. If you get a contemporary translation of her autobiography, do it. It's a fantastic book. Jack, thanks so much for that call. We got to keep moving. And so I'm going to Justin in Washington State, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Justin, you're on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Great. Thank you. So my question is, is there criteria or indications that the church uses that a miracle is authentically from God and not just a work of Satan? So for Fatima, for example, you know, how do they know that supernatural experience or act was definitively from God and not just something from the dark side?
Well, they're never definitive about these matters. Definitive is kind of a term of art in Catholic theology that refers to things that are infallible. And the church never rules on apparitions infallibly. It only establishes a recommendation based on probability. And so in the case of Fatima and other approved apparitions, the church has said, we've looked into this and it's credibly a miracle from God. And so it's recommended to the faithful, but it's not required belief, and we're not signing off on it infallibly. Having said that, there are indeed criteria that are used to evaluate apparitions and beyond that, miracles. The ones for apparitions you can find in a document that's actually on the Vatican website in the section for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It was published, I recall, in 1978, and it's called something like Norms or Criteria for Judging Apparitions. If you go to the CDF's documents webpage and look up apparitions, it's there. The criteria that get used in terms of is this from God, and they don't generally frame it in terms of is it from God or the devil. They generally frame it in terms of is it from God or not. And if it's not from God, it could be a number of things. It could be a misunderstood natural phenomenon. It could be a mental illness. It could be an imagination. It could be a deliberate hoax. It could be something from the dark side supernaturally. Among the criteria that would be used for discerning is it of God or not would be things like, is any part of the message that's associated with the miracle or apparition contrary to what God has revealed? This is a test that goes all the way back to the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy, one of the things Moses says is, now you may ask me, how are you going to know a true prophet from a false one? Well, if a prophet shows up and says, this is going to happen, and it doesn't, you know he's not a true prophet. Also, if he says, let's go worship other gods, you know he's not a true prophet, because that's inconsistent with what's already been revealed, namely, you worship only the God of Israel. So in the same way, if an apparition starts teaching something that's contrary to divine revelation or contrary to the teaching of the church is going to say, well, whatever this is, it's not from God, because it's pulling people away from his revelation. Maybe it's from the devil, maybe it's just a hoax, but it's not from God. Another criterion that gets used is, does the apparition or miracle or whatever the whole complex related to it seem to be leading people into sin of one form or another, including things like greed, because there have been people who've tried to make money off of miraculous phenomena. And this is something, as we saw with Simon Magus in Acts chapter 8, is not what God wants. The worker may be worth his wages, but that doesn't mean you can produce spiritual stuff just for money. And so if you see that there is a phenomenon of hucksterism around a miracle, that's a warning sign. If you see that the people involved in the apparition or miracle are seem excessively concerned with money and a posh lifestyle and things like that, that's a problem. If it's overtly superstitious in terms of making money, like do this, you know, send this chain letter on to people and you're going to have money come to you in the mail or something, that's not only superstitious and leading people into greed, it's also contrary to divine revelation. So the basic tests are, does it lead people away from God doctrinally, and does it lead people away from God morally? If it does either one of those things, then it's a sign it's not from God, because he wants us to grow closer to him, not farther away from him.
Okay, Justin.
Great. Is there time for just a quick follow-up on that one?
Yes, there is.
Real quick. Are there any, supernatural powers that are, when you look at a miracle, are reserved? I guess probably not the right way to word it, but reserved only for God, for example. The
creation out of nothing. Only God can create out of nothing.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
True thing.
All right. Thank you, Justin. Thanks very much. Jimmy, sometimes people say, I just want a clarification on miracles and this kind of thing because of that question. But sometimes people say, well, the Eucharist itself is a miracle and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But is that correct? I'm not saying that it's not miraculous, but it
depends on how you use the word miracle.
Okay, help me out there.
The term miracle can be used in multiple different senses. The root of the word miracula means something to look at and wonder about.
Oh.
So that's kind of the root notion of it. But then in theology and philosophy, it's taken on additional connotations. The way that I typically use it, and this is not the only way it gets used, but the way that I typically use it and that seems to correspond to the way most people mean it when they're asking questions like this, is an event that deviates from the normal course of nature that can reasonably be attributed to a supernatural cause.
Okay.
And then you need to establish what is that cause? Is it coming from God or his angels, or is it coming from some other supernatural source? like the devil and his angels.
And then stay away from those.
And stay away from those.
Yeah, those are no good. Jimmy Akin, thanks so much for another fine hour.
My pleasure.
Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book, Jimmy Akin's talk in MP3 format is available right now at Catholic.com. Just go to Catholic.com and you'll see a banner at the top of the page. Click that banner and you get that free MP3. Thanks for joining us. We will see you again tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.